I've entitled this message, The Defection of the Everyman. The Defection of the Everyman. Proverbs 28:19 says, where there is no vision, the people are unrestrained, but happy is he who keeps the law. This proverb encapsulates the reality of Israel in the time of the judges. Though, because of Yahweh's mercy, he sent various saviors to, it'll get better, I promise, to regularly rescue his people from the mess that they continually caused for themselves, they did not keep the word of God, and they did not have strong spiritual leaders to guide them in biblical worship. They had rejected that path. Remember, God gave them the land. All they had to do was to drive out the idolatrous Canaanites and embrace Yahweh as their true king. That was what they were commanded to do. They just had to obey. God said he would be their God and they would be his people. They would enjoy life living in the land of milk and honey that God had provided for them. But they did not obey the command to drive out the pagans from their inherited land. And as a result, they chose their own path, which they thought was better in their eyes. They decided that they would rather than drive out the Canaanites and possess the land as they were commanded to, that they would enslave the Canaanites and use them for their benefit. They thought that was the better plan. Let's take these people, let's dominate them, let's enslave them, and they can be useful to us. It was their own method, their own plan. This plan clearly did not work out. Rather, what Yahweh had warned them would happen did happen. They adopted the Canaanite ways of life, including their idolatrous and pagan practices, all of them. They began to intermarry with the Canaanites, with the pagans. And before they knew it, they were becoming fully Canaanized and they were flirting with complete apostasy. Consequently, they turned away from Yahweh and were given over to the foreign nations that they had sought to enslave to benefit themselves, who in turn, ironically, made the Israelites their slaves and continually oppressed them. So Yahweh sent deliverer after deliverer, savior after savior throughout this very dark period, in fact, the darkest period of Israel's history, to demonstrate his mercy in the midst of the mess that they had created. Because that is who Yahweh is. That is who God is. He is a God of magnificent, overwhelming mercy. Those deliverers included guys like Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, Gideon, Tola, Jephthah, and Samson, which we encountered over the course of this study over the last year and a half. These deliverers were exceptionally flawed in their character and in their faith, as we saw time and time again with all of the stupid decisions that they made. But Yahweh chose to use them and to cover them with his grace and to use them as a vessel to demonstrate his mercy to his undeserving people. However, in spite of that mercy regularly shown through the rescue of the judges, time and time and time again, Israel continued to spiral downward into complete apostasy. And as we have studied Judges this far, the first 16 chapters, and looked at the lives of these deliverers, and hopefully overall just seen that God is a God of mercy, using these men to demonstrate that mercy to his people, we've been challenged over and over also by these reoccurring themes in this book. We've been challenged by the dangers of compromise and complacency. We've been challenged to think through personally how we flirt with compromise concerning sin or complacent lives in terms of being fully devoted to God. Are we dabbling in that? This book has challenged us concerning that. We've been challenged concerning the destruction of idolatry. That as you begin to cultivate idols in your life, whatever those idols look like, and you wander down that path and you refuse to turn away from those idols, the inevitable result always, 100% of the time, will be complete and utter destruction. We've been challenged by that. We've been challenged a lot, I think, by the deceitfulness of sin. Sin is so much more deceitful than we can even imagine. It is so alluring. It gets into the crevices and the core of our beings, slips into those places where we're not keeping track of things in our lives, and that's where it begins to infiltrate and penetrate. All of a sudden, you have this full blossoming sin issue because sin is that deceitful. We've been challenged by that. We've been challenged by the deadly allure of temptation that is not squashed. I would challenge all of you. Yesterday we had our men's breakfast, and I had the privilege of having one of my best friends out here who spoke at that breakfast yesterday. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 through 13. It'll be posted on the website. I challenge all of you to listen to that message. It was compelling. It was challenging, and it was really deeply related to the things that we've talked about through the book of Judges in terms of dealing with temptation and squashing it appropriately. We have been challenged by that as we have seen temptation overtake the people, overtake the judges, and their failure to squash it and what that led to. We've also been challenged by the reality of the demoralization of a society that seeks to create its own kind of worship and false gods. We have watched what happens to a society when they reject the way that God has said they are to live and created their own path, which inevitably led to idolatry and then creates massive problems. It's demoralized. Finally, we've been challenged by the demonstration of undeserved mercy from a loving and gracious and compassionate God. And we have come back to that theme every single message. And as we walk away from this study this semester, yes, Judges in large part is awful. The sin that occurs in the book of Judges is awful. It's startling. It's shocking. And the fact that these are God's people makes it even more terrible. But friends, as we finish this out, and we're going to get into some pretty deep waters in these next few weeks. As we finish this out, you need to understand that the overarching, dominating theme of this book is God's mercy in the midst of the mess. Don't forget that. Keep that on the forefront of your minds. And we have been challenged by that. I have been challenged by that. I mean, I think about the messes of life that I have encountered in ministry. I think of the messes that I have made in my own life at times. And the very reality that God is so merciful and so gracious and so kind to reach down and deal in a very compassionate way with me, with people who love him, is amazing. It's overwhelming. We have been challenged to consider that. And as we have seen, the heart of this book, because it's so many chapters, is focused on the deliverers and God's mercy demonstrated through them. But now that they have been discussed, the author turns his attention to the everyman and the nation of Israel to present a picture regarding how much they as a nation, every human in that nation, had become increasingly Canaanized. That's what the author wants to demonstrate. He's shown the path of the deliverers and God's mercy through them. But now he wants, as he closes this book, it closes on a pretty tragic note. And he wants to show that this is how far sin takes you, to where it affects every human in this society. That's his purpose in these chapters. And this is critical to demonstrate that the apostasy wasn't just relegated to a few of the rogue tribes, to some of the tribes on the outer skirts of the nation, but rather that it encompassed the entirety of the nation. And this is why the author of Judges includes this third and final section in this book. This section, it runs from 17 verse 1 to 21 verse 25, and it's considered the epilogue. This section portrays the complete defection of the entire nation of Israel. This first segment of this epilogue is focused on the Danite tribe, the tribe of Dan. And the second segment is focused on the Benjamite tribe. And these tribes, why the author uses these tribes and pulls these terrible encounters and stories out of these tribes, is because these tribes are in the heart of Israel. When you think of the land of Israel, they're not some tribe that's way here, way here, way. They were central in the history of this nation. They're not the fringe, and he does this to represent the comprehensiveness of the entire nation's spiritual demise and corruption. Well, the first segment regarding the Danites runs from 17 verse 1 to 18 verse 31, and we'll cover these verses, this message, and next message, Lord willing. The theme of these verses in this first segment that run from 17:1 to the end of chapter 18 is this: it is a nation that lives for itself and its desires apart from God brings upon itself chaos and destruction. A nation that lives for itself and its desires apart from God brings upon itself chaos and destruction. The theme, I believe, could also be stated in a much more personal way. That is this: one who lives for himself or herself, and his desires or her desires apart from God bring upon himself or herself chaos and destruction. And the way that we see this theme unfold is by observing three sobering consequences that embracing a lifestyle of idolatry produces. Three sobering consequences that embracing a lifestyle of idolatry produces. And the first sobering consequence that idolatry produces is found in chapter 17, verses 1 through 6, and it is this: it creates an abode for pagan worship. It produces an abode for pagan worship. Notice the way verse 1 begins. It says, "Now there was a man in the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah." This is an unfortunate name because my son is Micah. I told him, "Son, I'm going to mention you a lot tomorrow in the sermon." But this isn't this Micah. This is a different Micah. And there are a few observations to make note of at the beginning of this narrative, that this man Micah, who we are introduced to, is portrayed generally to emphasize the universal state of the nation. So we don't get a lot of background information about Micah. Well, we don't get to know a lot about his family. We'll meet his mother, but we don't get to know a lot about Micah. And that's purposeful by the author, to keep it general, to emphasize the universal state of this nation. Next, ironically, this man's name, Micah, means "who is like Yahweh." That's very ironic. Another observation here is that there is uncertainty regarding when these events actually took place in the time of the judges. We know for sure that it was during the time of the judges, as verse 6 points out. As it says, "In those days there were no kings in Israel." So we know it was in that time, but we don't know chronologically exactly when this occurred in the time of the judges. It's important when you think about the judges, and we kind of went through them chronologically, the judges, because that's how they're portrayed in chapters 1 through 16, that they may or may not have been in order. We know that this was about a 400-year period in the time of the judges where these particular saviors were brought to the surface by God to deliver his people. But where they actually were in light of the nation, we're not 100% sure. It looks to me, personally, as we went through, that they're pretty chronological. But this particular time period, now 17 through 21, it's not just so after Samson this happened. This part of the text is to emphasize that this was the nation of Israel during the time of the judges. So keep that in mind. This story begins to unfold in verse 2. Look at it with me. He, that's Micah, said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." Apparently, this man Micah was a thief. He had stolen 1,100 pieces of silver, which was quite a bit of money, from his mother. We aren't told why. Who had subsequently put a curse on her own son without knowing. So he had stolen it. The mother was unhappy. And so she said, "Cursed be whoever took the money." And we understand that from our perspective. We would not be happy if someone stole a massive amount of money from us. And we may or may not put a curse on them. I don't know what that means for us. If you're putting curses on people, we should probably meet. I don't think you're supposed to be doing that. But we would be angry. And we would probably in our hearts and in our souls wish demise upon that person. That's just how we are in our flesh, corrupted. His mother's unhappy. She puts a curse on her son. She doesn't know it's her son. The idea of this curse was she wished bad fortune. She possibly even wished death upon the one who took all this money from her. Well, very nonchalantly, it's all happening in one verse. The author tells us that Micah then confessed that he was the thief. Again, we have no context for this. This is just happening in the time of the judges. And so the story is going to continue to unfold. It's going to make a lot more sense. But right now we have this guy who's a very vague and general Israelite who steals 1,100 pieces of silver from his mother and then tells her, "I took it." Probably he heard the curse and didn't really feel good about that. And so gave it back to his mother. And so she then changed her curse, which is weird, to a blessing, which means that she desired for him to be fitted with strength. Of course, if your child steals from you, depending on your relationship with your child, you're probably going to change that curse to a blessing. You don't want to wish death upon them, even if they steal a lot of money from you. That's how good parents are. Remember that as you become parents. But that's what happens. But more importantly, this oath that involved kind of the curse and the blessing was actually a symbol of the deep Canaanization which characterized Israel at this point. Now, this was a very mystical thing to do. I mean, just think about like the New Age movement and all the weird stuff that goes into that and people talking about cursing people and all this kind of stuff. This was that. This is what the author is bringing out, that this mother did this because she had been very influenced by this society. This is how Israel was. They had been very influenced by this mysticism. Put curses on people, you're cursing them to the gods. The gods are going to come down and deal with them. You're blessing them. The gods are going to bless them. It's just this mentality. The author is bringing that to the surface. This is the type of action that the pagans would take. This is how the pagans operated. The Canaanites did this stuff. This wasn't to characterize God's chosen people. That's what he's emphasizing, even by just jumping into this story. This is where they were. They were living like the people they were supposed to drive out. His mother's decisions in verses 3 and 4 continue to present a picture for how Israel had become an abode for pagan worship. Look at verse 3. He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to Yahweh for my son to make a graven image and molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you. So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. This is bizarre. This is a bizarre encounter. She consecrated, she set apart, now that she received these 1,100 pieces of silver back, she set apart those 1,100 pieces of silver as sanctified, you saw it in verse 3, to who? To Yahweh. By having her son oversee this unauthorized worship practice. What was this practice? Well, you saw it as we read. This was for him to take this, to go contact the silversmith, apparently, and to have an image carved out of wood or stone. That's this graven image. It's something carved out of wood or stone. And then the silver was to be melted down and poured into a mold to make some kind of image to be worshipped. This molten image, that's they would take the metals. Remember the golden calf. Golden calf is an example of a molten image. They took all the gold, Aaron did, and formed a calf. And this was done by the silversmith, the local guy down the road. So Micah returned the money to his mother, and she dedicates 1,100 pieces of silver to Yahweh in a pretty unique and terrible way. But she only gives 200 pieces of the silver to the local silversmith to construct this image. I mean, there's a lot of problems with how all of this is unfolding. She's making these vows. She's throwing curses upon her son. She's changing them to blessings. Now she's making these vows saying, I'm going to take all this money, I'm going to devote it to Yahweh. And the way I'm going to devote it to Yahweh is I'm going to make idols. And yes, I'm going to devote all 1,100 pieces to Yahweh, but I'm only actually going to give 200 pieces for this to happen. What happened to the other 900 pieces that had been fully devoted to this purpose? We have no idea. We're not told. But understand this, that detail continues to highlight this unprescribed, half-hearted, idolatrous worship that filled the land. I mean, just reading those first few verses of chapter 17, you're thinking, most of you have been at Countryside a lot of your lives. You are under good theology. You know that when you start reading about something being devoted to Yahweh and then idols being the thing that comes out of that is probably not good. That's what was happening in the land. Everything about this entire encounter was unprescribed, that means not given to them directly by God in the scriptures. It was unauthorized, and it was completely pagan. The unprescribed method of worship was absolute paganism, and it was forbidden by the second commandment given in Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. You're familiar with the Ten Commandments. Let me just remind you of chapter 20, verse 4. It says, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth, beneath or in the water under the earth. That is to say that we're not to try and create in our own wisdom, in our own creativity, in our own minds, some sort of image of God and put that image there for us to worship. That's what the Israelites did with the golden calf. They said, we gotta have a vision, we gotta have a picture of what this God is like. They were trying to take Yahweh and make him into a physical image. That was the golden calf. That's exactly what's happening here. Exodus 20, verse 4 forbids that. We aren't to take God, who is far above our thoughts, far above our ways, who is infinitely greater than us because he's holy. He's completely other, completely distinct. We are never in any way, shape, or form authorized to take him and to create some sort of image that we can bow down before that represents him. Ever. That was happening. Verse 5 details the full-fledged idol factory that Micah's house had become. Look at verse 5. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and the household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. This man, Micah, was apparently the spiritual leader of this house that him and his mother lived in. And he had children, so maybe he had a wife, probably had a wife. And he set up a temple for all of his idols in his house. That word shrine is what tells us that. That word shrine means a house of gods. So within his house, he creates this temple where then all of these images get put. And not only did he construct a small temple, which was completely against what God had given instructions concerning, but he also consecrated one of his own sons as his personal priest in a very bizarre and paganistic way. His son was to be the one who led the worship in Micah's self-constructed worship center. Levites, you remember Levites. Leviticus talks a lot about Levites. Exodus, Numbers, the Pentateuch deals with Levites. They had a specific role. They were the ones prescribed by Yahweh to lead the worship in Israel. The Levites. And God was to be the one who consecrated priests, not men. Yahweh was also the one who had prescribed where the places of worship would be for the various tribes. And that's all given to us in the Pentateuch. Israel knew this, at least generations before. By this time, probably not. The entire scene, this entire scene in these verses exposes the blatant rebellion to the command given by Moses in the first part of Deuteronomy 12. We need to go to Deuteronomy 12 for just a minute. Because, again, this was explicit. God had described what is exactly supposed to happen. Deuteronomy 12. So we'll read a few verses, beginning in verse 1. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which Yahweh, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live on the earth. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their ashram with fire. And you shall cut down the engraved images of their gods and obliterate their name from that place. Pretty explicit instructions. You shall not act like this, that is, like they acted, toward Yahweh your God. But you shall seek Yahweh at the place which the Yahweh your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. There you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the contribution of your hand, your votive offerings, your free will offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. There also you and your households shall eat before Yahweh your God and rejoice in all your undertakings in which Yahweh your God has blessed you. You shall not do at all what we are doing here today, every man doing whatever is right in his own eyes. For you have not yet come to the resting place and the inheritance which Yahweh your God is giving you. When you cross the Jordan and live in the land which Yahweh your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies around you so that you live in security, then it shall come about that at that place in which Yahweh your God will choose for his name to dwell, there you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, your tithes, the contribution of your hand, and all your choice votive offerings from which you will vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before Yahweh your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, since he has no portion of inheritance with you. Be careful that you do not offer burnt offerings in every cultic place you see, but in the place that Yahweh chooses in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. Friends, it couldn't be any more clear. And we see even through Moses' words, as he is reminding, Deuteronomy is to remember the covenant before you go into the land. He's reminding the nation of everything that they've come through. He's reminding them that they've already struggled with this in some sense. They've already at times lived like there was no God, lived like they had no king. And so he's saying, this cannot happen. When we go into the land, this is exactly how it is to be. Exactly. Yahweh had clearly prescribed how worship was supposed to be done and where worship was to be done. Verse 5 of our text also summarizes all of the aspects of idolatrous worship that characterized Israel during this time. And they were very comfortable in their abomination. Look at verse 5. And the man Micah had a shrine, made an ephod and household idols, consecrated one of his sons that he might become a priest. All of these practices are being used by the author to summarize the reality of the pagan worship that dominated the everyman of this country. The constant rebellious idolatry that Israel continued in despite Yahweh's mercy, friends, it produced a dwelling place or an abode for pagan worship. It was welcome there. Pagan worship practices were at home in the land of Israel. Well, in verse 6, we find the author's assessment of the canonization of Israel. Look at verse 6. A familiar theme. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And these first 5 verses communicating to us this pagan worship practice and method by Micah and his mother represented all of Israel. That's why the author summarizes it this way in verse 6. He wants us to picture that this was not some pocket of the land. This was the state of Israel in the time of the judges. This verse emphasizes the complete corruption of the individual rebellious hearts of the Israelites. They were supposed to live under Yahweh's authority as their king. They had rejected that authority, and their corrupt hearts, friends, were unleashed in the nation. Friends, when idolatry prevails in your lives, it opens the door to false worship, setting up camp and finding a home to dwell in your life. When idolatry that you dabble in, that you refuse to put to death, prevails in your life, you are swinging the door wide open to false worship coming in and setting up camp, home in your life. Idolatry must never be coddled. It must never find itself comfortable in our hearts. Rather, every idol that our flesh raises up must be met with forceful opposition. It must be resisted by the means that God has given us in his word to fight sin. Friends, it must be cast out at every spot. It must. Because that's the picture we see of Israel. We are getting a glimpse of what it looks like when idolatry is allowed to prevail, to settle in, to be comfortable. This is what happens. A fully paganistic society. And very personally, when idolatry prevails in your life and you don't cap it, you don't put it to death, you don't remove it, you will begin to look like the nation of Israel. Now, I think about ministry. You know, I think this year I've been in ministry 20 years in the various churches that the Lord has graciously allowed me to serve. And I think of people. They disappear. You don't know what happens to them. Come to find out, they had begun to coddle a life of idolatry. And their lives are a complete disaster. They have completely defected. People, not people on the fringes. Not people that when they came in to wherever I've served where I thought, yeah, they're probably not going to last too long here for one reason or another. But people who were in it, devoted, and now are gone. Why? Because of this. This is the result. Serves as a warning to us, doesn't it? Challenges us. We must commit ourselves to the spiritual disciplines that God has prescribed. Why? To keep from becoming fertile ground for idolatry to begin to grow. What do I mean by that? When your life as a Christian simply begins to consist of you being at church on Sunday and Wednesday. And that's really the whole spiritual aspect of your life. And you're not personally committed and devoted to knowing your God, to a personal relationship with Him through the Word. You're not devoted to prayer. You're not devoted to serving His people and to loving His people. You're not devoted to those things. What does that do? Well, that you don't have a heart at that point that's fertile for the truth. You begin to have a heart that's fertile for idolatry. Because that becomes the thing that is easier to come into your life if you're not cultivating these things. See, spiritual disciplines, the things that God has given us, keep us from becoming fertile ground for idolatry. A sobering consequence to embracing a lifestyle of idolatry is that it produces an abode for pagan worship in the nation of Israel and in the hearts and lives of individuals. But there's a second sobering consequence that embracing a lifestyle of idolatry produces, which we find in verses 7 through 13, and that's this. It produces an affront to prescribed worship. An affront to prescribed worship. In verse 7, the scene shifts to another young man, another random individual in the nation. Look at verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. Then the man departed from the city from Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim to the house of Micah. So we see these two random individuals in this narrative now collide. This young man, known by the way that this word young is used in the Hebrew language, this young man is probably not quite of priestly age. And He was living disobediently, though he was a Levite. The detail that he is a Levite emphasizes for the reader, don't miss this, that we're not just talking about the everyman and every just random individual in the nation, but this detail that he is a Levite emphasizes for the reader the state of all the religious leaders in Israel at this time. It wasn't just the common people. Now, the author wants us to understand that the state of Israel included all of the religious leaders as well. Just like Micah represents all of Israel, the Levite represents all of Israel's religious leaders. This Levite was a descendant of Gershom, and we'll learn that in chapter 18 because we're told that specifically. Gershom was the son of Moses. So he was from that heritage. One author puts it like this: he was a member of the Kohathite branch of the Levitical tree. It's important. And because he was of this branch, he was to live in Ephraim. And we see that in Joshua chapter 21. It's worth turning there. Joshua chapter 21. Let me just read a few verses out of this to understand why this guy is disobedient. Joshua chapter 21, verse 4. Then the lot came out for the families of the Kohathites. And the sons of Aaron, the priest, who were of the Levites, received 13 cities by lot from the tribe of Judah, from the tribe of the Simeonites, and from the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, drop over to verse 26, or 20, sorry. Then the cities from the tribe of Ephraim were allotted to the families of the son of Kohath, the Levites, even to the rest of the sons of Kohath. They gave them Shechem, the city of refuge for the manslayer, and its pasture lands, and the hill country of Ephraim, and Gezer with its pasture lands, and Kibzam with its pasture lands, and Beth Horon with its pasture lands, four cities from the tribe of Dan, Elkdeke with its pasture lands, Gibeathon and its pasture lands, Ahialon with its pasture lands, Gathrimon with its pasture lands, four cities from the tribe of half-tribe of Manasseh. They allotted Taanach with its pasture lands and Gathrimon with its pasture lands, two cities. All the cities with their pasture lands for the families of the rest of the sons of Kohath were 10. A lot of strange names. Sorry, probably mispronounced all of them. But the point is this. This Levite was specifically told to serve in a very particular city, Ephraim. So if you go back to the text and you look at verse 7, it says, this young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah. And where was he staying? It says there. So he was living in Bethlehem in Judah. This is why I labeled this guy as disobedient. Again, you've got to understand that God prescribed these things for a very particular reason. These were a chosen people, chosen out of the rest of the people of the earth for them to look in upon this people and see the blessing of God and thus see the salvation of God come from these people. So there were very specific prescriptions for them. So this man living in a, who is a priest, a spiritual leader, or becoming a priest as he got older, spiritual leader, was to live in the city that was prescribed for him, and that was Ephraim. He wasn't living there. He was living in the wrong town. The Levitical priesthood was meticulously described in Leviticus. Its ordinances were to be strictly kept. This wasn't happening because the prescribed worship of Yahweh had been tossed to the curb. It was gone. Therefore, this man, we find in verses 7 and 8, was wandering aimlessly, having not been supported in his role. Like, this just wasn't happening. He wasn't in the place he was supposed to be, getting ready to become a priest as he was supposed to be. He was in a different land, and he just wandered off. In verse 9, the author restates the part about the priest wandering and his first interaction with Micah. Look at verse 9. It says, Micah, verse 8 rather, this man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. The commentator Younger says, this restatement of the dialogue, the fact that he was from this particular country, emphasizes this Levite was a wandering opportunist. He took his priesthood show on the road looking for a payday, is what he's saying. This was absolutely against what God had prescribed in the Pentateuch. Look with me at verses 9 and 10. Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" He said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to stay wherever I might find a place." Micah said to him, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance." So the Levite went in. Micah, as he met this priest, remember, Micah is all about developing this new method of worship that was somehow gratifying his flesh, and he thought was pleasing God. And so he, thinking, probably mystically, "I just encountered a Levite. I mean, I've made my son a priest. That was good enough for now, but now I have the golden honey. I have the thing. This is the key to the blessing of God in my life." He wanted to manipulate God's favor by getting an actual Levite as his priest. And in his superstitious mind, he had to be thinking, "This priest is the key to unlocking the blessing of God in my life." And what did Micah do for the priest? He said he offered him a good life. In exchange for what? Becoming his personal priest. Where is that prescribed? In the Pentateuch. Of course, the wandering Levite accepted the offer, as it has become clear that he was looking to get paid for his services. Look at verse 11. The Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. This priest that the author brings to the surface here in this epilogue was an affront to the worship that God had prescribed. He was disobedient, and he had spiritually prostituted himself to gratify his greed. That is what the religious vibe of the nation of Israel had become. This entire transaction that we just read was an affront to the true worship that Yahweh had prescribed. Wrong method, wrong place, wrong God, wrong motivation. Look at verse 13. Then Micah said, "Now I know that Yahweh will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as a priest." You see his mysticism. This priest, because he was a Levite, Micah saw as his genie in a bottle, so to speak. "I've got my wishes are coming true. This is awesome." The worship that Micah was establishing at his house was completely syncretistic. It was completely syncretistic. Throughout this narrative so far, you have seen the name of Yahweh invoked at several points. Right? You've seen it, the name invoked by the mother. You've seen the name invoked by Micah. You've seen the name of Yahweh invoked here by Micah again as the priest agrees to be with him, to be his personal priest. However, mixed with saying this worship to Yahweh are all of these idolatrous pagan practices that we have seen. That's syncretism. The blending of paganism with the worship of the true God. And don't miss this. Syncretism is always, always a symptom of apostasy. Micah took bits and pieces of the prescribed worship to construct his own style or method of worship to suit his tastes and the desires of his flesh. And what did he do? He expected God's blessing for it. And as awful as this sounds and the awful things that come to our minds as we think about this, friends, we have to ask the question of our own hearts. How often do we do this? We mix our own methods, our own desires, our own feelings into worship, into how God has prescribed that we are to worship him. We mix those things together, and what happens? Well, we expect God to bless us. How many churches who have considered themselves Christian churches do this? For example, think of perhaps charismatic churches, seeker-friendly churches. So a charismatic church, one of the key components of a charismatic church is the mixture of emotions driving the worship. Not that we aren't to be emotional creatures in worship. We are to worship God with all of our hearts, all of our souls, all of our minds. We are to worship God. We are to love God. There's affections for God. All of that is true. By the way, I just ordered a book that my buddy recommended to me called Feelings and Faith by Brian Borgman. Write it down. This is one of the most common things I talk to college students about. Feelings and Faith by Brian Borgman. Get the book. I've ordered it. It should be here for me very soon. I'm going to read it, but I'm recommending it based on his recommendation. I guess it has been fantastic. He has two college-age sons. They're working through it. It has been life-changing. Feelings and Faith, Brian Borgman. How they mix, because there is a mixture. Because we're not stoic robots. We have feelings, we have affections, we have emotions, and they are out towards God, and that's good. But what has happened is those emotions and those feelings have taken a higher priority than the prescribed truth of the Word of God. And so what do? We succumb to those things, and our hearts are led astray because they're corrupt. Jeremiah 17:9 tells us that. And so what happens? Well, then we create this new religion based on how we feel. That's not prescribed. That's unauthorized. That's one of the small ways we do it. They allow their feelings and desires to dictate their worship practices rather than the scriptures. The worship, friends, that honors God and that he has prescribed and provided in his word is that which he has prescribed and provided in his word. And we don't have the right to add to it. And we don't have the right to take away from it. Because that's syncretism. And any form of syncretistic worship is an affront to a holy God who has told us and has the right, by the way, to tell us how to worship him. This is what happens when idolatry is adopted and embraced. This was the epitome of apostate worship, and all of Israel was involved in it during these dark days in the book of Judges. Next time, Lord willing, we will look at a third sobering consequence that embracing a lifestyle of idolatry produces. But I think as we close our time, now, I just want you to turn to Isaiah chapter 40. I want to be reminded by the prophet Isaiah regarding just how incomparable Yahweh our God is. This is why we worship him. This is why we're not syncretistic in our worship. This is why we worship him as he has prescribed, as he has demanded. And this is what honors him. Because this is who he is. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 18. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. A goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself a skillful craftsman to prepare an idol that will not totter. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth. And its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. Scarcely have they been planted. Scarcely have they been sown. Scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth. But he merely blows on them and they wither. And the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me? that I would be his equal, says the Holy One. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created the stars, the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing. This is the God that we serve, all-powerful, worthy of every aspect of our praise, and why he has the right to dictate to us in his word how we are to worship him. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for who you are. You are a magnificent God, a God who is beyond our comprehension in so many ways because you are completely other. You are completely distinct in your likeness. God, may our hearts worship you as the one who is worthy of our worship. May we be careful to see how we are to worship you through your word. Lord, may we adhere to the principles that you give us, to the instructions that you give us for how to worship, and understand that that's what brings you glory, that when we create our own methods, our own ways of doing things, when we bring any kind of idolatrous worship into the true worship of God, that dishonors you, that angers you, and that it will not be put up with. Father, keep our hearts from idolatry. Keep our hearts pure, clean, fertile for the truth. Give us a deep love for Christ, for his word, for his church. God, may we be enthralled by your greatness and captured by your wonders. We love you and praise you. Thank you for our time together. In Christ's name, amen.